Yeah, hey, we are back here at WGXC 90.7. I am Mr. Petey Pete, and I am so elated to have my regular monthly guest here, Sylvia Hasenkopf. Sylvia, I'm sure there's people that listen to this on a regular basis because I have so many people that stop me in the middle of the street and say, you know, I love it when Sylvia comes in. It's such a great show.
Well, and, I'm honored to be here.
But why don't you, even though you're here on a monthly basis, why don't you tell the people a little bit about yourself and then we'll get going with the show.
Sure. Born in Canada. My parents actually were both immigrants from Europe after World War II, and they met in Niagara Falls, Ontario. And not long thereafter, I arrived on the scene and grew up in Canada till the age of 40 when I married my husband, who is from the Caro Round Top area, and moved to the United States. Although I've known this area since I was a young child because my husband's aunt is actually my godmother.
Really?
So, yeah, the families all knew each other in the old country. So I've actually been coming down to, you know, gorgeous Greene County since I was about 6 or 7. My husband's family bought the Crystal Brook Resort in 1960. So my mom and I used to come down all the time on vacation. And I actually worked here in the heady days of the late 60s. I stayed for the whole summer, you know, like when Tommy was hot, you know, on the radio.
Right,
and
right.
Cream and all that kind of stuff. I remember those days with great fondness. And I worked at the resort doing dishes. So anyways, many, many years later, my husband and I are now married, and I've been living here for 20 years. But I've been fascinated with American history simply because in Canada, you learn nothing about it. You know, we learned that the Canadians won the War of 1812. We did because the Americans did not take over the country.
Yeah, whatever.
But, you know, it was interesting for me moving here to actually learn American history, and I am now a full-time historian and genealogist and writer, and have published books. I write for the Greenville Pioneer, a monthly column on a local, not monthly, every time the issue comes out, I have a whole page, if not more, in the newspaper on a historical article of some interest to me. And we talk about some of these things when I come in here because I have written 231 articles now and getting ready to write my 232nd article.
Yeah.
So,
well, why don't you give where that can be reached? Where they can look that up and
sure.
on the internet? And
sure. Andrew Macko is the editor and owner of the newspaper. It is based out of Greenville. I've been with the paper since it first came out, first issue in May of 2010.
Okay.
And you can get the paper in Coxsackie, Greenville, Durham, Caro, Westerlo, Preston Hollow, Rensselaerville, and also by subscription. If you go to www.greenvillepioneer.com or go to their Facebook page, it is relatively inexpensive. I think it's less than $30 for a year subscription. It is a biweekly.
Okay, well, that's good to know. Now, let's get into the subject we were talking about.
Sure.
This really, and I had said this a couple times earlier today, I'm very interested in this because you know, we've been broadcasting out of the Catskill Library for some time, and I know that the philanthropy from Carnegie led to the library being here.
Absolutely.
And there's a plaque up there that I've looked at and kind of read through many a time, too. And I know some bits about it, but I'm not really too knowledgeable on it. But if we could go through the history of Carnegie and then maybe some of the things that he had talked about. I mean, I know that at the end of his life, he had said that all people of wealth should be donating their money to good charities.
Absolutely.
But you can get into that.
Oh, yeah. Andrew Carnegie is a fascinating man. I don't know if you've seen, a few years ago, they had The Men Who Made America. I think it was a series. It was about Carnegie, J.P. Morgan.
Was that the one, though, that where they kind of said that they were ruthless?
They were.
Yeah. That was the one that, yeah.
It was a fabulous story. It was like a docu it wasn't a documentary and it wasn't really a movie, but it was like how they've combined the two now, a docuseries, I guess. And so there was acting and there was actors, and it was really a great eye opener. I have checked the veracity of a lot of the comments and acting, and it's pretty true to form. And Carnegie was quite ruthless in his own way, but then that was the way people made money back then. That's how you became a businessman. That's how you became successful. And quite frankly, when you think about Andrew Carnegie's origins, I mean, he was born in Dunfermline, if I'm saying that correctly, in Scotland on November 25th, 1835. And he emigrated with his family to Allegheny, Pennsylvania at the age of 13. This is an immigrant family. They had nothing. His first job was as a bobbin boy, changing spools of thread in a cotton mill.
Yeah, didn't he make like $1.20 a week or something to that effect?
Yeah, he actually made $1.20 a week, and he worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. And that's way before there was any notion of it was not a good idea to have children as laborers. I mean, those laws didn't change until 1916, actually. But he worked 12 days a week, if that's even conceivable today to anybody.
How do you work 12 days a week?
Oh, sorry, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week.
Yeah, I know.
I think my schedule's 12 days a week, to be honest.
I know the feeling.
So anyways, that's where he got his start. But, he was a hard worker. He wanted to succeed. He wanted to have more than what they came with. So, he was always looking for an opportunity to improve himself. And there was a gentleman in the area named Colonel James Anderson who had a personal library of 400 books. And he would open up that library every Saturday night to the local boys to come in and allowed them to read his books. And Andrew Carnegie took advantage of that.
When you say local boys, yeah. I mean, was it literally just for the boys back then or...?
Yeah, pretty much. Girls, really? Girls were really tied to the house. In my experience and research so far, unless you had any kind of modicum of wealth, girls were tied up in laundry, taking care of younger children, baking, making soap. Everything had to be made back then.
Right, right.
So there was not that much leisure time for poor girls. And they didn't also have the same kind of freedoms to roam. You know what I mean? To go here or there like guys did,
Right.
So in this case, from what I understand, it was mostly the boys that came in to look at these books by this Colonel James Anderson. And Andrew pretty much, he took advantage of that. He read everything he could. And so he slowly took monies that he made, started investing his fortune.
And I'm sorry.
Because he learned a lot.
So he really didn't have any formal education. It was basically self-taught through reading. And that's an important aspect of it because I believe he said one of the downfalls of America is lack of education that
Correct.
He believed. And yet he wasn't formally trained, and yet he taught himself in so many respects.
Absolutely.
But he said that that was a detriment, that he felt that that was the downfall of the Americas, was the lack of education that the people...
Well, it wasn't just America. This was pretty much happening everywhere. You were required to go to school from, 1803. There was legislation in place where children had to go to school.
Okay.
And we could do a whole different, talk about that. But basically, they went short periods of time, and if they were needed on the farm, they were excused. There was a push for people to be able to read. It wasn't like everybody was illiterate. And when you look at the censuses, it was mostly older, very older people. If you start in the 1850 census and you look at it, it would be people that are older than 40 or 50 or 60 that were illiterate for the most part. That's not a rule. And you would see most younger children could read. And that was really because of the push for public education, which started in the very early 1800s. But Andrew Carnegie's famous quote is, "It is the mind that makes the body rich."
Mm-hmm.
And he really believed that. He felt education and the ability to read, the ability to have access to books is what allowed him to become the industrialist he became.
Right.
And so that was really important to him. So he actually built Pittsburgh's Carnegie Steel Company. right from nothing, basically, just by investing and shrewd business moves and all that kind of stuff. And if you watch the show, you know, The Men Who Made America, it gives you a great deal of detail as to how that happened.
And I'm sorry to stop again, but it was so important because at the time that he built the steel industry, that's when America was burgeoning in its growth, and that parlayed into the use of steel. And I mean, that's why, in a way, that's what excelled everything. He was lucky in a sense, but he was also very smart.
He was at the right place at the right time.
That's what I meant.
Let's put that way, because we were entering in, you know, between, you know, after the Civil War, right up into the early parts of the 1900s, it was the golden age of America.
Right.
You know, we had all these huge industrialists that came up, but we also had technology that was catching up as well, that allowed these men to take advantage of things. I mean, steel was something that nobody knew about. You know, it was really a fairly new construction. Things were made of wood and brick. Hmm. So when did steel really come into play?
Okay.
It was during this age.
Right.
And this is when, you know, skyscrapers also started to be built.
Really?
Yes, and that's another story, because the guy who invented that process is from Catskill.
Okay.
So we'll do that another day.
All right. So
it's a very fascinating story.
Stay tuned for that.
Yes, and so the ability to build higher than six stories,
right,
was really invented in the late 1800s.
That just sounds kind of funny, the ability to do six stories as big as the buildings that we have now.
Right, because you didn't have a skeleton, let's put it that way, a strong enough skeleton to build higher than six stories. So in the old days, they would build using brick and wood beams. And
right.
You can see this here in Catskill. If you go down to the old mill that's right down on Catskill Creek that was just purchased by a young lady from Brooklyn, an artist.
Oh, you mean on River Street?
Orens, yeah, Orens.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The old Orens.
Okay.
You'll see these, I forget what they're called. There's a real specific name for them. There's these, they look like stars.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yeah.
They are steel beams that go right through the building and hold the building together.
I see. And
that's what they're for.
I always thought that was for people when they did delivery, they would do like a pulley up to that. Really? I didn't know that.
No,
then.
If you look, you'll see them at regular intervals through the building, and they basically have an iron rod that goes right through the building and holds the structure. It became part of the skeleton.
I know. I've seen that up there, and that's what I always thought it was for deliveries.
Okay. Nope. And so you could only go up six stories. Otherwise, the entire structure of the building was, you know, unstable.
Okay.
And then you had, you know, the skeletons that started to be built, and then they were first on the outside of the building.
Okay.
And then with the development of steel, you could start building girders for the interior of the building. So it moved from being an exterior skeleton to an interior skeleton. And then also the whole idea that you could build bridges with these huge steel beams, which was unheard of before Carnegie.
Okay.
And there's a very famous part of the movie, you know, The Men Who Made America, on how he does that. He's building this bridge across the Missouri River, I think it was. I'm really guessing on that. But it's a fascinating story of how he used steel to do that. And that became really the whole beginning of the steel industry in America and how he made his fortune.
Right.
And he almost lost the business and everything at that point. But he proved that it could work. And people were afraid to go across that bridge because they didn't think it was stable. So he got an elephant.
Really?
To walk across that bridge.
And that's then everybody, clever. That's very
and
clever.
Then everybody walked off. Walk behind the elephant to the other side, and his fame was made. But prior to that time, he was at risk of losing that business on an hourly basis.
Wow.
It was that tight. You know, it was a really amazing story. So his ability to make steel and his ability to supply enough steel for bridges, for, you know, the burgeoning skyscraper industry and so on, is what made that business so successful and him such a billionaire, quite frankly. So eventually, Pittsburgh Steel, Carnegie Steel, merged with Federal Steel Company to create U.S. Steel.
Okay, I thought there were four of them.
Carnegie sold U.S. Steel to J.P. Morgan.
Okay.
And that's where the other ones got folded in, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. So anyways, they were called the captains of industry. It was like Carnegie, Rockefeller, Ford, and who's J.P. Morgan.
Okay.
So those were the captains of industry who really drove the growth, the exponential growth of American industry in the late 1800s.
I mean, comparably speaking, even back then, compared to what the value was and the economy, I think I'm wondering if they were had even more money back then than, say, the rich people of today.
Of course.
Yeah.
You know why? Because their workers made nothing, and they worked 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, no benefits.
Are we talking about then or now?
Then. Yeah, that's a good point, too. But, I mean, there was no worker protections. You
right.
could have children working in industry. And actually, an article I wrote for the Greenville Pioneer that's out right now is about a man named Lewis Wicks Hine, whose father was actually born in Cairo. And Lewis became known as the man who photographed children working in all these industrial locations in the first decade of the 20th century.
The photographer.
He's a photographer. Okay. And he actually was trained as a sociologist. You know, he was a teacher in New York City. And he used his camera to capture immigrants coming off the boat. He used his camera to capture children working in unsafe conditions. Later on, he captured the building of the Empire State Building. He captured men working with machinery. And it was his photographs, of which I think there's 40 to 50,000 still existing.
I think I'm sure I've seen some of those, and they're quite incredible because it really captures the moment.
It captures the moment, and he has amazing photos of these kids that are children, I mean, less than 12, working in a coal mine in Pennsylvania, of girls working in cotton mills, changing bobbins, just like what Andrew Carnegie did.
Mm-hmm.
And because of all those photographs that were so in the face of the American public, Congress changed the laws in 1916
really?
To stop children under the age of 14 working in factories.
Really? Okay.
So he was a game changer. But so during Carnegie's time, Rockefeller's time, J.P. Morgan's time, people could employ children and have them work these incredible hours in unsafe conditions.
Okay.
And pay them next to nothing and lock them out if they so wished, anybody, any worker. So upon that, you know, men like that were able to keep the money for themselves.
Okay.
You know,
yeah.
and build their fortunes. And the average man just labored at next to nothing wages. So, yeah, it was really skewed towards, you know, men of wealth.
Well, okay, I'm going to segue into your next program. You are coming on at 2 o'clock this afternoon, I believe.
Yes.
And I think, if I'm correct, were you talking about the railroads?
Yes.
And that parlays into, you know, I mean, that in itself, there was so much labor that was put in that was people
mm-hmm.
were treated like...
Oh, yeah, the construction of the entire railroad industry in North America is a fascinating story. But at 2 o'clock, myself and Roger Liller were both with the Cairo Historical Society, met with Jack Sensabaugh on Backtracks in Time.
Yep.
And we were talking about the Cairo line of the Catskill Mountain Railroad, about the Otis, about the Canjoharie and Catskill Railroad, some of the things that the Cairo Historical Society is doing to actually preserve this history.
Okay, so you can tune in for that at 2 o'clock, but back to Carnegie.
Sure. So anyways, Carnegie, I think at some point realized he was a wealthy man, you know, he was valued at $480 million, you know, in the late 1800s, approximately $10.3 billion in 2003 prices. And that's what his company was worth in 1901 when he sold it to J.P. Morgan.
Wow.
So somehow, this boy who came over, you know, in the early 1860s, built a company in 40 years that ended up being worth in our prices early 2003 of over $10 billion. And he was quoted at that time as saying that he only needed $50,000 a year to live. So he really didn't need the rest of the money in his estimation. So he intended, and he said flat out that he was going to give his fortune away.
Oh, okay.
You see? And so what he did is his greatest passion, of course, was libraries. And so he decided that he wanted to set up a program where towns and cities could build libraries, and he would support that initiative. So he said, free libraries maintained by the people are cradles of democracy, and their spread can never fail to extend and strengthen the democratic idea, the equality of the citizen and the royalty of man. They are emphatically fruits of the American idea, of the true American ideal. So he believed in giving to the industrious and ambitious, not to those who need everything done for them, but for those who, being most anxious and able to help themselves, deserve and will be benefited by help from others.
Well, you know, it's so true, because when I come here, and I come here on a very regular basis, and it's so helpful to see the community here. There's so many people here. There's so many people here waiting outside to come in to the library to open. I mean, and that's just talking about the library. I'm sure there's many other things that you can talk about, but specifically that you said he has such a desire and interest in libraries. Yeah.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, from 1886 to 1919, he funded 2,509 Carnegie libraries worldwide.
Wow.
1,689 of them in the United States alone. He was also the founder of Carnegie Mellon University, Carnegie Institute of Technology, and Carnegie Hall in New York City. And that's just a few of the institutions he helped fund with his billions of dollars. So you got to give the man credit. He put his money where his mouth was. He just didn't talk about philanthropy. He really embodied philanthropy. He also funded the construction of 7,000 church organs. And he was also a benefactor of the Tuskegee Institute.
Really?
Yes. So, you know, I give him a lot of props.
Bless his heart.
So he in August of 1919, he was dying, you know, on his estate in Lenox, Massachusetts. He had given away $1,653. Which is approximately $4.3 billion in 2005 figures.
Which is 90% of his fortune.
Absolutely. And at his death, the remaining $30 million of his vast fortune was given to foundation, charities, and to pensioners. And he actually had set up a pension fund for his former employees. So
he did.
Yeah, give him a lot of credit, you know. Wow. So how did we get a library here in Catskill? That's really, that in itself is a story. So I thought we'd talk about that a little bit, if you wouldn't
yes.
mind. You know, I was curious when I first started putting the article together, and I wrote this article on the Catskill Library. Gosh, I would say that's back in 2011. So I had never heard of a Carnegie Library. You know, it was something that we didn't have necessarily in Canada. I mean, I remember skipping along to the library when I was like 7 years old, you know, taking books out on dinosaurs. That was my passion at the time. I wanted to be a paleontologist like there was no tomorrow.
So literally you were skipping?
Oh, yeah, I skipped. I rode my bike.
Okay.
It was about half a mile away.
Go ahead.
And every Saturday I was allowed to go to the library by myself, you know, and I would hoof off there and take out books and bring them home and read them. And it was something that is one of my fondest memories of growing up in London, Ontario, Canada. Anyways, here in Greene County, the earliest library that I could find was the Durham Library Company, which was already an established institution in what was then called New Durham, New York, you know, which is Durham, New York, in September of 1793. There was an ad for this establishment in the Catskill Packet, which was the local newspaper out of Catskill, and it was announcing a meeting of shareholders, and it was calling for payment of shares. So the earliest library we have in Greene County was one, it wasn't even Greene County at that time, to be honest, it was Albany County. We didn't become a county until 1800. But it was one where it was a shareholder thing. No, it wasn't open to everybody. It was only open to those who owned shares in the company. The earliest notice I found for the village of Catskill, however, was an ad in May 1802, and it was called the Catskill Library Society, and they were meeting at the house of Terence Donnelly, and they were getting together in order to organize themselves. So the point here is that in the early days, libraries were not open to everybody. Libraries were open to people who could afford to own shares or to be in a subscription basis with that institution. If you were poor, you didn't have access to it.
So it was a library / country club?
Not really. My experience is that it would be in someone's home. It wasn't like they had a building. It would be housed somewhere, and only people that owned subscriptions to it or were members in it financially in some way could actually pull a book out to be read.
Okay.
So if you were Joe Blow down the street who was struggling to make ends meet, you didn't have access to those books.
Yeah.
And in fact, there were people that had sizable libraries here in Greene County. We had men of industry of our own, you know, Isaac Prine, James Powers. These, you know, Terrence Donnelly was actually a hotel keeper where the mail stopped, you know, the stage mail stopped. So there were people that actually had some money, but they would have had books of their own. And very few other people really could have afforded to have books at that time. So then you move forward really quick. The first public library in Catskill was organized in 1893.
Okay.
So just think, that's a whole century.
I was just putting those figures in my mind there.
And that's the first public library. And so the Catskill schools had donated a bunch of books to this organization, which formed the nucleus of its collection. And the original librarian was Emily Becker.
Emily
Becker. And she organized the books. They, you know, put everything together. They actually found a location. It was located on Main Street near Thompson Street. It was a small little place. They built shelves around the outside walls. They put library books in there. They had one kitchen table in the middle, only a couple chairs, because people didn't go in there to really hang out. They just went in to pick up a book and then go back home. That's pretty much how that worked. It was a pretty simple process.
Okay.
But they started to grow, and people started to donate more books, and they realized that they needed a library in Catskill. So the newspapers of the day provided a number of editorials starting around May of 1900, where they're talking about the fact that the trustees of the village of Catskill are agitating to build a new library. And so the editorial that appeared in the Daily Mail in May of 1900 basically said, "The building must be a credit to the town and appeal to the patriotism and liberality of the people of Catskill." So we know that in April of 1899, the village board had met and had appropriated $3,000 towards this cause. And so they purchased the property at the corner of Franklin and Bridge Streets, where this building actually is today. But it wasn't really a square parcel at that time. They had to buy later another parcel to square out the property.
Okay.
They purchased the lot for $3,000. It included the livery stable of Mr. Cargill. It was 92 feet on Franklin Street, 64 feet on Bridge Street, and 48 feet on Howard Street, which is that little, not even a street anymore. Howard's Alley, going down to Howard's Alley.
Right.
The committee felt that without extravagance, a substantial and commodious structure could be erected, which may fittingly serve for the present as well as for the future of our people. So they started to solicit for private contributions, because $3,000 was enough to buy the land, but they needed to still build the property. And they finally raised enough money to have $5,500 in their kitty. But I think they realized they didn't have enough money. You know, they really needed to find more. So it came down to Judge Emory A. Chase and Catskill Savings Bank President W. Irving Jennings, who decided to call upon Andrew Carnegie in 1901, in February. They had heard about his philanthropy, and his special interest in funding public libraries. So they went out to Massachusetts to his estate in Lenox and sat down and had a conversation with him.
Now, when you say Chase, you said the banker Chase?
No, Judge Emory A. Chase.
Okay.
That's not Chase from the bank.
Okay.
That's a fairly prominent New England name, and we had our own Chase family here in Catskill.
Okay, I just didn't know if there was...
They could be related. Who knows? Okay. I haven't done that genealogy yet.
All right, there you go.
But anyways, Andrew listened to them, said he would consider it, asked for a proposal. He said, I know about Catskill. It's a pretty nice summer resort. So, you know, Catskill was known as the place to go as a summer resort. It wasn't a place of industry. It wasn't a place people thought of immediately as a hotbed of commerce. It was a tourist industry even that far back. So Jennings and Chase put together their proposal. They sent it to Andrew. He considered it. He wrote back and he said, you know what? If Catskill will pass an ordinance to pay $2,000 a year to maintain a suitable library, I will give you the money sufficient to build a building.
Right on.
Yep.
All right.
Yeah, but how do you get $2,000 a year? That's a lot of money in the early 1900s,
right.
You know? How do we raise $2,000 every year? They had to make the commitment to do it every year.
Okay.
It wasn't just one time. It was forever. And that became a little bit problematic. They tried to negotiate that down to $1,500, but Carnegie stood firm. No, he said it has to be $2,000 a year. And then he would give them $20,000 to build the library. So basically, the committee said, well, maybe we can make an endowment out of the money that we already have raised. By March of 1901, they had raised $8,800. But they had to buy additional land to square out the property, as I was mentioning before. And so that cost of $1,500, bringing their available endowment money down to $7,300. It was the nucleus of their permanent endowment. But still, that wasn't enough to, you know, you wouldn't make enough money on $7,300 to come up with $2,000 a year.
Right.
So the trustees said, okay, can we raise this through our taxes? Well, there was no laws in place at that time that would allow them to do that. So they had to go to Albany and actually have a law enacted, which allowed them to raise money for libraries.
Through taxes.
Through taxes, which we all do today. And this was started by our Catskill boys.
Really?
Yeah. Isn't that a cool story?
Not really.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty cool. So anyways, they were successful. And in the Examiner of March 30th, 1901, it was announced that Senator Wiley introduced two bills in the legislature respecting the public library building, which Andrew Carnegie has offered to erect in Catskill. My, that was fast. Judge Chase had drafted the bills. So they had worked really quick to get the bills in place. Now, I think it was only for Catskill, but this is now a commonplace occurrence where we raise taxes for our local libraries through monies for our local libraries through our taxation
process.
Excuse me, I'm still recovering myself.
Okay.
So anyways, it became the law. The money was raised. On June 18th, 1901, the citizenry of Catskill went to the polls, and their voice was heard because they were asked, are you willing to do this?
Yep.
And it was almost unanimous, 180-8. So in other words, almost everybody at Catskill really wanted that library and were willing to help fund its ongoing budget of $2,000 and only 8 dissenting votes.
Okay.
So, like most people, not everybody showed up to vote that day. So, anyways, Earl and Fisher of Worcester. I always find that funny. It's spelled W-O-R-C-E-S-T-E-R. Being a good German person, you know, you Worcester. Pronounce every letter. So I would say Worcester, and they're going, no, it's Worcester.
Oh, okay.
W-O-O-S-T-E-R. That's how it's said. Okay, so Earl and Fisher of Worcester, Massachusetts, were elected the architects. And the design and the design and plan of the building went to George W. Halkett, one of their staff and a former Catskillian. So that's how they got the contract.
Okay.
So it was accepted by the library trustees and the advisory council. And the building, the proposed building was described as a handsome two-story and basement brick building with stone trimmings in the French modified classical school of architecture. It goes on to describe the library in great detail. And what I find amazing today as I walk in is that it looks just like that. Like, I mean, things have not changed.
Well, if you go to our website at WGXC, they have a picture.
Yep.
And on that picture, that's a beautiful picture from, what did you say that was, around the 19...
I would say about 1910, 1912-ish right. period. It's got the ivy going up the side. I actually have a picture in my archives of the building of the library. So I'll send that to you, Neva, so we can put it up on site and then people can see what it was like when it was being constructed.
Right.
It's a really cool picture, actually. So this was something Carnegie asked for in every library, and is that every library had a staircase to get in. And what he said, that symbolizes a person's elevation by learning.
Wow.
There are also, outside of almost every library, at least one lantern or lamppost, which is a symbol of enlightenment. We have two. And I think that's pretty cool. That kind of symbolism is just like perfect.
It is.
So sealed bids went out for construction. And, you know, the bids came in. They closed on September the 7th, 1901. George W. Holdridge and Son, who did a lot of construction in Catskill, received the masonry contract valued at $8,228.47.
Okay.
E. Lampman and Son got the carpentry work valued at $5,718.53. H.K. Hill, the painting contract, valued at $500. Day and Holt, the heating contract, valued at $908. And Catskill Illuminating and Power Company, the piping contract, valued at $120.
Where does Mid-Hudson Cable come into it?
I don't know. Are they here today?
I'm joking.
I know. So George Holdridge did become the general contractor. And, I mean, that man's history of building in Catskill and the environment around us is absolutely legendary.
Right.
You know, he built so many buildings.
Right.
So on October 24th, 1901, the cornerstone for the Catskill Public Library was laid. Deposited in that cornerstone is a box containing 11 different newspapers of that week, including the Catskill Examiner, the Daily Mail, and the Palinville Zephyr.
So it's still in there now.
Yes, it is. Also in that box is a library history, a list of contractors for the building construction, the coins of 1901, and a Pan American souvenir.
So literally, if I came there tonight where nobody was up and I could chisel away and get
bite
that
your
out. I don't know.
Don't
what
give people ideas here. I think you need a jackhammer, and it might hurt the place a little bit.
No, I'm just totally being facetious.
But it's in there, yes.
Really, I didn't. That's kind of neat.
That's very neat, I think. So once the building was built, then all of a sudden, the next problem: how do we get the furnishings? You know, how do we put things inside it? And people got excited. Donations of books, of furniture, money started to pour in. People wanted to be part of the final phase. And some of these things are still upstairs. Mrs. Mariah Schuyler Doan, the widow of John Doan, who was a doctor, MD, presented the library with two Rand McNally and Company library globes. One of them a terrestrial globe and the other a celestial one. And I think they're still up there.
Oh, really?
Yes, I looked at them. She also donated a complete 30-volume set of the 9th edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica, handsomely bound in half Moroccan, along with a bookcase.
Well, you know, I have to give Sue and all her compadres yes. credit for keeping this library still in a beautiful, intact, and added so many different aspects of the library that are so unique here and so nice and so community oriented. It's not just a simple, you could say a simple library. There's a lot of love and character in here that she has carried the torch to keep it what it is.
Absolutely.
And I'm not just saying that to say it, but it's true.
You know, times have changed. And I recall one of the biggest issues when I moved to Cairo was whether Cairo would build a new library.
Okay.
And we do have a stunning new library today, but we do still have a group of people who feel that that library is useless and oppose it to this day.
Because?
They feel we don't need it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand myself. I'm still mystified. Yeah. To me, libraries are very much a center of learning, a center of the community, a cornerstone to our commitment to those who don't have the funds to be able to buy their own books or to have the internet or to learn on their own. It becomes the place people can go of any age, of any economic level of wealth, and enjoy the fruits of knowledge.
It's so true. I mean, like I said at the beginning of the conversation, there every day there's people waiting outside, a line of people waiting to come in that make this a regular jaunt. And it is. It's so helpful to so many people. Even speaking for myself, I spend a lot of time time here. I love, and you, I mean, there's so many things if you have the ability to do it at home, but sometimes it's nice to be out doing it with other people.
Absolutely.
Here. And so, yeah, I totally am.
And I think that librarians today have come to realize that they have to change with the times and meet the needs of today, which means the internet, which means the library being a place where community events can be held.
And there are many here.
Where lectures occur, you know, where you actually are teaching. And Carol has done a really good job as well. Greenville is, like, amazing. I give lectures up in Greenville, all kinds of things. So basically, the library is up and going, and I've almost been talking for a whole hour. I can't believe it. Time just flies by.
Well, we could end this by saying, and then he died in 1911.
Pretty much. But his legacy continues to this day, and his teaching is still there here in Catskill. We have this lovely building.
Yes.
And unfortunately, a lot of his buildings have now been changed and sold. Some of them are museums, coffee shops. We're lucky here in Catskill that we still use the Andrew Carnegie Library as the library. So I think it's something to be justifiably proud of.
Yes. Sylvia, thank you so much for coming in. You definitely inundated my mind with information, and I do appreciate that. I love that for somebody to do that to me. You will be back here next month again. I will be back here the same time, the same place next week. You are listening to WGXC 90.7. Corey is back, will be here as soon as I get off the air, so stay tuned for that. Everybody have a great week. Thank you, Sylvia.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye.